Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Today we have for you a brand new episode just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on November 1st of 2020 under the headline, Supreme Court, Anti-Slavery Laws Do Not Apply to Sailors. Here we go. In May of 1895, on the old San Francisco waterfront, four sailors signed on to the four-masted barkentine Arago for a voyage to Valparaiso, Chile, quote, and thence to such other foreign ports as the master might direct, and thence to return to the United States, all via Astoria. Well, by the time they got to Astoria, the four of them had had enough of conditions on the Arago. They stepped off the ship and essentially told the skipper, we quit. In doing so, they changed history, and the legal status of sailors would never be the same. The Arago Four were Robert Robertson, John Bradley, P.H. Olson, and Morris Hansen. And it's possible, in fact, it's rather likely, that they signed on to the ship with the intention of deserting in Astoria. The Seamen's Union they were members of had been hoping for a case like this to come up so that it could clarify in the courts a new law that had just been passed by the U.S. Congress. This new law had just been passed in February of that year, and it essentially decriminalized deserting from a merchant ship. Before, a sailor who quit a merchant ship in the middle of a voyage, like one who quit a Navy ship at such a time, he could be prosecuted criminally and sent to prison for several months. Now, under this new law, he couldn't. You could still get sent to prison for going AWOL in the Navy, but not as a merchant marine. The thing was, the law might have changed, but the practices of police and shipping masters had not. This is because they had never really enforced the law itself. They had used it for leverage to get the deserters to return to work. I mean, when a sailor deserted, the captain of the ship didn't want him in jail. He wanted him back on the ship making money for the company. So, before the law changed, here's how that worked. Because desertion was a criminal offense, the captain could call the local police to go out and arrest the deserter. After that, the cops usually preferred handing him over to the captain rather than spending the money and resources running him through the local criminal justice system. The skipper would then put the deserter in irons until the ship was safely out of swimming distance from shore and then make him go back to work. That's the way it had always been done, as far back as anyone could remember. What had changed legally was that now the local cops did not have a legitimate reason to be involved, because deserting the ship was no longer a criminal offense. But skippers were still calling cops, and cops were still collaring deserters and dragging them back to work at gunpoint. They were now essentially acting like a freelance enforcement squad for the ship owners. The union felt, not unreasonably, that regardless of whether a deserting sailor was treated as a criminal or just as a runaway worker, this practice was a direct violation of the 13th Amendment. That would be the one that had abolished slavery and indentured servitude at the termination of the American Civil War. So their plan was to get a test case sent before the Supreme Court, which would, of course, be forced to rule in their favor, since the 13th Amendment, very specifically in an extraordinarily unambiguous language, outlaws all forms of involuntary servitude except for prison labor. Then, of course, the Supreme Court would order police departments to stop doing this. That's what they thought. Well, they could not have picked a better place to run this play than Astoria. Astoria was a notoriously tough port in which to replace sailors. The town was small enough, and relatively good-paying timber jobs were so close by and so easy to get that crew members were hard to come by. Which is, of course, why Astoria had such a reputation as a nest of Shanghaiers. At any other port, the skipper of the Arago would have been far more likely to chalk it up to experience and hire replacement sailors out of a local boarding house and be on his way. But because there were four of them, it would cost a lot of money to replace them in Astoria, if it could even be done. And sailing all the way to Valparaiso, short four men on a modern barkentine, the Arago was only 3 years old, that would be a bad and risky plan. So the skipper took the bait, as it were, had the four men arrested and hauled before a justice of the peace. The JP, well trained in the old ways, promptly stuffed them in a holding cell at the local jail until the ship was ready to weigh anchor, at which time a U.S. Marshal escorted them back aboard ship, like they'd always done with runaway slaves hauling them back to the plantation in the bad old days, and of course ordered them to get back to work. But the men, believing they now had a right to quit work like any other American worker, refused to turn too. So the captain clapped them in irons, made an unscheduled stop at San Francisco to drop them off and replace them from a boarding house there, and was on his way. In San Francisco, the four men were promptly arrested and thrown in the Alameda County Jail to face charges of refusing their work, which, unlike desertion, was still a crime. When they got their day in court, the judge, as expected, ruled against them. So, backed by their union, they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then everyone waited for what they thought was an inevitable verdict affirming the unconstitutionality of forcing sailors to work against their will. That's my cat, Rambo. He's lonely, apparently. Well, they must have been astonished when, a year and a half later, the Supreme Court issued its ruling. The 13th Amendment, with its prohibition of slavery in all its forms, applied to all Americans, no matter what their race, just as long as they weren't sailors. The case was Robertson versus Baldwin, and it became one of the most notorious decisions in Supreme Court history. For years afterwards, seamen referred to it as the Second Dred Scott decision. It essentially established the status of sailors as, well, for all practical purposes, slaves. Slaves for the duration of their open-ended contracts. Slaves until their captains decided to come back to the United States and end their tours. The court's ruling asserted that the 13th Amendment, when it outlawed involuntary servitude, was just talking about actual chattel slavery of the Old South plantation type, and anyway, the court added, servitude wasn't involuntary if one signed a contract to enter into it, a ruling which suggested that actual plantation-style slavery could in fact come back as long as the slave signed a contract up front saying it was okay. The court also ruled that using law enforcement to force a worker to fulfill the terms of a labor contract that he had signed was an acceptable practice, and it actually cited an antebellum court decision over runaway slaves as a legal precedent for this. The court's ruling went on to claim that the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, had only been intended to formalize an already existing colonial tradition of liberty, not to actually change anything from English law. This was an extraordinarily audacious and completely indefensible assertion, and totally untrue. Therefore, the court added, since that tradition had allowed sailors to be treated as indentured servants at the time the Constitution was ratified, it obviously hadn't been intended to apply to them, or they would have stipulated that it did. Okay, if you followed that, good on you. Very, very hopeful thinking there on the part of the Supreme Court justices. The ruling went on to cite precedents for treating sailors as literal wage slaves, including the laws of the ancient Greek mariners of Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, from 900 BC, and also the slightly more modern laws of the Hanseatic League of the Middle Ages, according to the latter of which, desertion was punishable by a year's imprisonment on bread and water and or by having the deserter's face branded. Finally, the justice wrote this oft-quoted gem, quote, "Seamen are treated by Congress, as well as by the Parliament of Great Britain, as deficient in that full and intelligent responsibility for their acts, which is accredited to ordinary adults, and as needing the protection of the law in the same sense in which minors and wards are entitled to the protection of their parents and guardians." In other words, the court ruled sailors are a special, subhuman class of persons, unfit to be entrusted with the full rights and privileges of citizens. They were not to be expected to stand on their own two feet, to make their own decisions, and take the benefits or consequences, like farmers and loggers and railroad workers would be. No, they had to be made to do as they were told, and in exchange, the government would see that they were taken care of adequately, fed sufficiently, not abused too badly, etc. Every American man, the court said, almost in so many words it said, every American man was endowed with certain unalienable rights by his creator just as long as he wasn't a sailor. Well, this was an 8-1 decision by the court, by the way. Every Supreme Court justice agreed with it, with one exception. That one exception was Justice John Harlan, and his dissent was brutal. The 13th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States declares that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly committed, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction, he wrote. Such is the plain reading of the Constitution. A condition of enforced service, even for a limited period, in the private business of another, is a condition of involuntary servitude. The placing of a person by force on a vessel about to sail is putting him in a condition of involuntary servitude if the purpose is to compel him against his will to give his personal services in the private business in which that vessel is engaged. He goes on to almost poke fun at the majority's citing of 3,000-year-old Greek and 600-year-old Hanseatic law as precedent. Why the reference to these enactments of ancient times, enforced by or under governments possessing arbitrary power inconsistent with state of freedom? Does anyone suppose that a regulation of commerce authorizing seamen who quit their ship without leave to be imprisoned upon bread and water for 1 year, or that required them to be stigmatized in the face with a letter of the town or state to which they belonged, would now receive the sanction of any court in the United States? But Harlan was just warming up to the part that must have really been music to the ears of the sailors. The further suggestion is made that seamen have always been treated by legislation in this country and in England as if they needed the protection of the law, in the same sense that minors and wards need the protection of parents and guardians, and hence have been oft described as wards of the Admiralty, he wrote. Some writers say that seamen are in need of protection of the courts because peculiarly exposed to the wiles of sharpers and unable to take care of themselves. In view of these principles, I am unable to understand how the necessity for the protection of seamen against those who take advantage of them can be made the basis of legislation compelling them, against their will and by force, to render personal service for others engaged in private business. The Constitution furnishes no authority for any such distinction between classes of persons in this country. The runaway seaman who breaks his contract, Harlan added, may be liable for damages for the non-performance of his agreement, but to require him, against his will, to continue in the personal service of his master is to place him and keep him in a condition of involuntary servitude. It will not do to say that by immemorial usage seamen could be held in a condition of involuntary servitude without having been convicted of crime, Harlan continued. The people of the United States, by an amendment of their fundamental law, have solemnly decreed that, except as punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, involuntary servitude shall not exist in any form in this country. By adding another exception to that blanket prohibition, Harlan said, the Supreme Court was engaging in judicial legislation, creating new law rather than sticking to its constitutionally limited role of clarifying and interpreting existing law, and thereby usurping the power of the legislature. It is a very serious matter when a judicial tribunal, by the construction of an act of Congress, defeats the expressed will of the legislative branch of the government, he concluded. It is a still more serious matter when the clear reading of a constitutional provision relating to the liberty of man is departed from in deference to what is called usage, which has existed for the most part under monarchical and despotic governments. Zing! Of course, in the short term, this was quite a setback. But Harlan, needless to say, turned out to be the one who was right about this. He was right about something else, too. He pointed out in his dissent that this ruling would be used as a precedent for reintroducing indentured servitude into the United States. And within a few months, that was already happening as states in the defeated South started using it to defend contract labor, drag them back to work laws for the benefit of the plantations that had formerly been worked by slaves that were now worked by, essentially, wage slaves. It wasn't a good look. Nor was the decision popular in the press. "The American merchant marine has been disgraced in the eyes of the world," the Oregonian wrote in its response to the ruling, "and labeled with the iron bands of such slavery as threatened the very foundations of this country in 1860. Immediate action is necessary to save our sailors from infamous imposition more degrading than they have suffered in the past." The U.S. Congress was not amused either. Harlan's caustic observation that the decision amounted to judicial activism was not overlooked by the lawmakers who had voted for the law it overturned. Within months of the decision, they had replaced it with an even stronger version called the White Act, which closed several loopholes and included desertion in most foreign ports as well as domestic ones. The shipping interests, which had been happily celebrating their victory, by the end of the year surely wished they had not gotten involved with it. Getting law enforcement authorities out of the contract enforcement goon squad business was a great first step for American sailors, but they wouldn't actually be free to quit their job without consequences for another dozen years when the Seamen's Act of 1915 passed. Nonetheless, it might have taken a good while longer than it did for sailors to acquire the full rights of American citizens had it not been for the Arago Four walking ashore in Astoria and refusing to go along the path of temporary slavery that had been marked out for them. Key sources in this story included works by Leon Fink, Paul Schuster Taylor, Joe Streckert, and the Portland, Oregonian Archives. Well, there you go. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For more details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m., so it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.